I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Joining me now is Astra Taylor, the writer and documentary filmmaker, has written a new book, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. It's a really engaging book, as well as a strident call to arms. In the book, Ms. Taylor dismantles the idea that we're in some sort of utopia where technology levels the field, so to speak, when it comes to hearing everyone's voices. The internet really reflects and amplifies the inequities we see in the world. In fact, those who already have attention and influence get more. I'll ask her why, what she feels ought to be done, and more, especially the idea that the old media model really hasn't worked its way into new media, and we're not really in a new world after all. As well, we will reflect on the idea of the value of one's work, not to mention authorship and ownership. Astra Taylor is an activist. Her films include Seasick, The Examined Life. Her writing has appeared in a number of publications, including The Nation and the London Review of Books. She co-edited Occupy, Scenes from Occupied America, and helped launch the Occupy offshoot Strike Debt, and was one of the instigators of the Rolling Jubilee campaign. The website for more is at hiddendriver.com. The book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto today, Astra Taylor. Ms. Taylor, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So as I told you before we started, this is a really engaging book. Why do you think that we think that the internet is the panacea when it comes to equality, access to information, freedom even?
Well, that's what we've been told for a long time. And there are elements about it that both feel and are true. And so I think it's a complicated thing to discuss. And so much of the mainstream conversation falls back on a sort of black and white framework, like the internet is making us stupid, or the internet's actually making us smart, or we're distracted, or no, we're brilliant multitaskers, the internet is good, the internet is bad. And one thing I wanted to do with this book was think through that muddle, and to maybe go to the next level and think about how the internet actually is shaped by the social context and the economic realities of our world, and so in that sense, we're always doomed to be a bit disappointed, because the promise of a sort of public-spirited, democratic, open, accessible network, I maintain, cannot be actualized to the full to its full potential in a market-driven bottom line obsessed world, and that's where the disconnect is. That ultimately, these new platforms are forced to be the handmaiden of profit because we haven't investigated alternatives. So I suppose that's where my Occupy spirit does come in.
So the parameters of the conversation essentially, or the framework with which we're working in this world. I mean, this is the old model, the sort of capitalist sort of society. I mean, does that have to change, do you think, so that the good that the internet could do would be fully realized?
I mean, it needs to be at least resisted. And, I'm not holding my breath for a total economic revolution, but I think that it's something that we have to be aware of. So, this idea, for example, that kids today are all distracted by their devices and exposing themselves online, and I think, you have to look at the incentives that are built into social media. Why do social media sites function in such a way that they're constantly trying to get us to click more and to reveal more personal information? Well, that's because it's the business model that they have to serve. And why are people so willing to be present on those platforms? Well, for a lot of people, they don't have a choice, because job opportunities are tied to your social network. And, it's not... I feel like the conversation... We have to understand the economic context in order to understand the technology, but that doesn't mean that we have to wait for a whole-scale upheaval for the more positive elements to be strengthened. I think there's a lot we could do in the here and now.
So to get it straight, if we fail to understand sort of the basis of all this, the economic structure, mm-hmm. we're just doomed to repeat the same mistakes that we made elsewhere.
Yeah, and the same mistakes of the old media model that we were supposed to overthrow. So, you know, people were rightly disappointed in television for being, you know, a sort of advertising-driven wasteland, right? And then the Internet comes along and is supposed to provide an alternative. But we've basically let advertising be the sort of lifeblood of the Internet. We expect these free services, expect things to be free, and as a result, there's the phrase that's very popular in tech circles, which is, if you're not, the user is the product. That basically, it's a very similar model to television in the sense mm-hmm. that it's our attention that's being sold to advertisers to fund all of these private platforms. But the worrying thing is that the technology is far more advanced and personalized and invasive, and there are all sorts of worrying repercussions. And so, and there's this sort of back to the future element where it's almost like the early days of TV in the U.S., where we had where all the shows on television were branded like the Camel News Hour and stuff. And, mm. and basically, there was a huge scandal and public outcry, and civil society revolted, and then there were protections put in place. And a wall was built. It wasn't a perfect wall, but a wall was built between advertising and editorial. So that was something that it didn't just naturally come with the technology of television. It was a social invention that people advocated for. And so it's interesting now that we're in a moment where lines are blurring. I mean, The Guardian, now has just announced that some of their environmental coverage would be sponsored by Unilever. You know, there's this blurring between what is advertising? What is the supposed news content? And so, it's funny how these new tools have brought us in a way to where we were back in the day. And I think if we don't confront these issues head on, that what you said is exactly true, which is that we will be doomed to repeat some mistakes. Only I think the stakes are higher in the sense that now all of our communications travel through one channel, in a sense. And the technology, again, is so much more advanced in terms of personal tracking and all this. So I think the stakes are higher than they were.
So if The Guardian doesn't have, I mean, I don't know if they're making this argument, but the argument that we're seeing with other outlets like The Guardian mm-hmm. is that if they don't have people sponsoring them as they do wholesale, like with Unilever, mm-hmm. It may not exist 5-10 years down the road. I mean, isn't that a trade-off that perhaps one ought to make?
Well, I mean, I think on the level of a single institution making a choice, or even a single individual making a choice, then we always have to make trade-offs, right? Yeah. We always have to figure out what it is we're willing to do, or how much we can compromise. One of the aims of the book is to, giving specific examples, trying to keep the broader social view so it doesn't become reducible to an instance of an individual selling out or The Guardian selling out or, well, they made the right choice because there were no other options available. I mean, this is a broader social problem, and it has to do with the fact that we've basically handed over this public good, which is journalism and you know, aspects of art and culture, to advertising, instead of bothering to conceptualize or advocate for other modes of financing them, which, you know, people have organized such things in the past. And so I think it's you know, whether that choice was right or wrong isn't exactly, I think we need to ask the sort of bigger question, which is, how did we get to a point where that seems like the rational choice, where advertising is the only option? Because as I point out, ultimately, advertising is extremely inefficient. I mean, for all of the talk of disintermediation and efficiency that these technologies were supposed to bring us, I mean, advertising is really inefficient. And the other thing is that we as consumers, we pay for it. I mean, the costs are built into what, you know, we pay for products. So it ultimately is a kind of private tax, and it ultimately isn't transparent or accountable. It doesn't have any of these values that supposedly we're supposed to represent this new age, you know. So we're paying for it. We don't get we don't have any control over it. So I think it's amazing that it's the common sense. Sort of, it depends what perspective you look at it. On one hand, it's just the way the world is. Advertising, fact of life. There's more and more of it every year. From another perspective, it's an amazingly roundabout, inefficient way of funding these services and the culture.
Yeah. Now, I looked you up on Google a couple of days ago, and I found on YouTube two of your films online on there. I'm assuming you didn't upload those yourself.
No.
No. So this.
But I also didn't take them down, which sort of proves how, which is maybe emblematic of my confusion.
Yeah. So I mean, how do you react to seeing? I mean, this is obviously hard work, many years of work that you've put into these films. It costs a lot. You talk about that in the book about, you know, you interviewing a guest at one point. A subject in the film through the rear view mirror because you were driving them somewhere. You know, a lot of money for equipment and the sort. So how do you sort of balance that with sort of getting the movie out there so that people will, you know, see the work that you've created?
Yeah. Well, again, I tried to use my personal experiences as a window onto broader social conditions and contradictions and to articulate a kind of bind that people are in. Because there's a, you know, each chapter kind of deals with one area where we sort of expected technology to bring a very clear social benefit. So we talk about the enthusiasm about the rise of amateurism or the idea that diverse, marginalized voices would necessarily have equal space, or a chapter on copyright, because that's been and will continue to be a really controversial subject. And it's something that, as a documentarian, I have a very, intense relationship with, because as a documentarian, you often use other people's material and you depend on historical archives and such stuff like that. But then also you have your finished product, which you want to have some control over as you share it with the world. And so it's a balance. I mean, I sort of left. I have not. Done any takedown requests for those films on YouTube, in part because I think there is a benefit to having it out there. But yet I respect people who are frustrated by specific uploads. I mean, a musician was recently complaining about the fact that before a video for one of his songs, there was a Newt Gingrich ad commercial, on YouTube. And he said, "I didn't okay this. You know, I've sacrificed and I've lived this life as a poorly remunerated musician, and now, you know, here it is. It's just got this pre-roll with Newt Gingrich on it." And I respect it, you know, his decision to take it down if that's what he did do. But I wanted to underscore in that section some of the paradoxes. So, you know, I wrote to one person who had uploaded the film before it was officially released, and I just said, "Hey, could you wait a few months and then maybe put it back up? But, you know, I'd like to have this window to try to do a more formal release." And they really acted as though I was just a controlling, dogmatic elitist, because philosophy is free and the world needs to see my film. And I just felt like, well, you really want to have it both ways, because you believe this film should exist and you believe you should have it for nothing. And yet that's just an unsustainable attitude, you know.
Yeah. So what do you say to people? I mean, that we have a generation here, maybe a generation and a half, that expect a lot of stuff to be free. You know, not just films, music, but just news even, information. I mean, there is a cost inherent to all of this.
Yeah, there is. Well, I mean, I think the thing is that it's interesting how we frame that. This generation expects things to be free. I mean, the thing is that they actually have... they have been provided with free services and free content because, again, the advertising model is as American as apple pie. So it's not something that they've just come up with on their own, you know, because they're entitled. It's actually, you know, something. It's kind of, if you look at it from a different angle, then one can understand why they've come to expect it. And it, part of me wants, you know, is inclined to think, well, you know, we do pay enough. Again, we do pay hundreds of billions of dollars a year in advertising collectively. We do give away public spectrum to broadcasters. There are all sorts of subsidies that taxpayers ultimately are providing, and yet there's very little public benefit. So I'm not. To me, the problem isn't necessarily free. It's, you know, perhaps, I mean, ultimately things have to be paid for, but it's a question of how, and do we pay for them in the public interest, or do we pay for them through this roundabout privatized means? And I don't think people have thought through that enough. But I do think that there, you know, there is reason to worry. I mean, when this person said to me, you know, okay, we expect you to do this, or we expect to have these films for free, but and you can't have any control over how it's released in the world. There was a sense of like, okay, well, it could come to a point where I can't make something like this. You know, and we're seeing that, you know, on a much broader and more worrying scale in journalism, where American newsrooms have shrunk by 30%, and there are half as many reporters covering state capitals than there were 10 years ago. So, I mean, we're seeing there are points where people just can't afford to do the work for nothing, and so the work's not being done.
So if they haven't thought this enough, if people haven't thought this through enough, do you expect the change that you want could happen, or that there is a willingness for this change to happen?
I don't know. I mean, again, I hesitate to put it all onto the individual. I mean, I think, you know, writing this book has made me more conscious about subsidizing things that I think are really vital. And I think you do see, even in things like Kickstarter, which I don't think that is a panacea, and, but I think you see that people do want to support things that matter to them. But I think we need bigger solutions, and again, it's about the collective action versus individual action. I mean, I can, you know, and right now we have a collective system that I think is pretty wonky,
yeah.
And I would like to see something different so that we don't have to agonize as individuals over every single choice.
Yeah, and then if we have the sort of cultural democracy that you espouse in the book, I mean, a diversity of voices will emerge, right? And I think that's what the old media model has sort of, I guess, been successful at, is preventing sort of new voices to get out there.
Yeah, but, you know, it has it. But then at the same time, I have some data in the book that says, but, you know, that the people who are really have managed to accumulate a substantial audience in the digital sphere tend to actually be just as homogenous as the people who rose to the top of the old one. You know, so there are voices on the fringe, and there always have been. You know, and one shouldn't discount the value in that, and the connection as individuals we can have to finding voices that are outside the mainstream. But there's the phenomenon of the missing middle, in the sense that big things can get even bigger online, where they now can tap into a global space and become sort of global megastars. And there's a lot of small stuff, but there's kind of the middle space where that's what I think we need to worry about, and where we need more diversity. And we haven't really thought through how to support that.
Yeah. Who stands to lose if the role of technology changes in the world? I suppose it's the manufacturers, the people that create the technology makers. So I suspect at that point that they won't idly yield to, you know, the sort of world the worldview that you have.
No, I don't think so.
So what happens then? I mean, are we just at an impasse? Does this continue, the status quo, perhaps?
Status quo continue. I mean, the inertia or the momentum is on. The momentum is certainly on their side. I mean, these companies, which only a few years ago we were championing as the sort of underdogs, right, going to overthrow the big dogs, we're all so tired of, are now just absolute Goliaths. I mean, they're the biggest, some of the biggest corporations in the world. I mean, Apple is actually constantly sort of jockeying for number one position. And so, yeah, these are big companies who have now sort of, in the last few years, also recognized their might as lobbyists. So there's, you know, I saw a news report the other day about Google lobbying against legislation that would prevent people from driving while wearing Google Glass or other computing devices on their faces. So yeah, they've kind of discovered their lobbying power, and in that sense, you know, but it was all very predictable, and I think that's why the few years of just kind of naive utopianism were a waste, in the sense that we could have seen the way things were going, that this was where it was heading, and we could have been thinking better about how to influence them. But they're also not immune to public criticism. In the last few weeks, Apple has made some shifts to its production chain, looking for example, minerals that are not obviously from conflict zones, and taking a firmer stance on climate change and stuff. And so none of that is enough, but it does show that they are susceptible to public pressure. And there hasn't really been that much of it. I think there could be more, and you see little intimations of it. There's been a lot of conflict around the tech sector's influence on the city in San Francisco, with some pretty lively protests and blockages of the Google buses, which are the buses that transport tech workers. And so I think we shouldn't underestimate the potential power of civil society to change course.
Yeah, and so you're generally hopeful then, right?
There must be some sort of cliche about, what is it, pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will or something. I mean, I think the thing is that things have looked much more dire in the past, and people were able to gain ground on issues that seem far more intractable than the ones I'm raising in this book. I think the question is whether we really wanted the technological and media utopia that was described to us for so long. And if we did, then we kind of have to take responsibility and ask how to get there. We can't just expect our phones to do it for us.
Yeah, I guess that's what we expect. We expect technology to be the cure-all.
Yeah, and this is an age-old, I mean, centuries-old debate about labor-saving devices and what impact they would have on the economy and how eventually the machines would be doing everything for us. And then it turns out, well, actually, with every innovation, it seems like we're working harder and harder. And that's because, you know, ultimately, the context that these tools are developed in is what determines their impact. It's not necessarily the... And that's not to say that they don't... Technology can't help us with... grant us great leaps forward or whatever, but on their own, it's not enough.
Yeah, it's really the people, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is a fascinating book, Astra. Congratulations on it.
Thank you.
And good luck with it.
Cool. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. TheHiddenDriver.com is the website for more of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. From Random House, it's author Astra Taylor. Join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.